All right, strap yourselves in, because today we're diving deep into some pretty intense stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The Book of Enoch.
That's right.
Not exactly your typical Sunday school lesson.
Yeah. No.
This is extra-canonical literature.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, 1st and 2nd Enoch.
Right.
You know those ancient texts that didn't quite make it into the official Bible?
Right.
But offer some truly mind-blowing glimpses into the world of early Jewish and Christian thought.
Yeah, it's like peeking behind the curtain of the Bible a little bit.
Exactly.
And getting a glimpse into the wider conversations and debates that were happening in the centuries before and after Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
These texts were deeply influential, reflecting the anxieties, the hopes, and the theological wrestling matches of their time.
Exactly. Yeah. And with the Book of Enoch, things get really wild.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking fallen angels, forbidden knowledge, journeys through multiple levels of heaven.
It's wild.
And even glimpses of what might have influenced early Christian ideas about Jesus.
One of the things that makes Enoch so intriguing is that it's classified as what we call pseudepigrapha.
Okay.
Meaning it was written under the name of a revered biblical figure, in this case Enoch, who is known for his mysterious walk with God.
Mm-hmm.
And sudden disappearance for the biblical narrative.
So it's like the authors were using Enoch's reputation to give their message more weight.
Exactly.
Kind of like name dropping on a cosmic scale.
Exactly. They were tapping into the symbolic power of figures like Enoch, who had this direct line to God, to explore complex theological ideas.
Yeah.
And make sense of a world often filled with suffering and uncertainty.
Right.
It's no coincidence that a lot of this literature emerged during periods of intense persecution and social upheaval for the Jewish communities, like the time between 200 BC and 200 AD, when they faced pressures from figures like Antiochus Epiphanes and the Roman occupation.
So imagine living in a world where your temple is desecrated, your people are oppressed, and the future seems bleak.
Yeah.
These texts, filled with apocalyptic visions and promises of ultimate justice, would have offered a powerful source of hope and resistance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's where the term apocalyptic comes in.
Okay.
It's not just about the end of the world, as we often think of it today.
Right.
It's more about unveiling hidden truths, exposing the forces of evil at work in the world, and offering a glimpse of a future where good ultimately triumphs.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty of 1st Enoch.
That's right.
It's a composite text, meaning it was compiled over time, and it kicks off with the Book of the Watchers, which dives headfirst into a cryptic passage from Genesis, the one about the sons of God taking human women as wives.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Genesis 6.1 to 4.
Yes.
It sparked endless debate.
Oh, yeah.
And 1st Enoch offers a particularly vivid interpretation.
Okay.
It expands on those sons of God as fallen angels called the Watchers.
Right.
They descend to Earth, get a little too close to human women.
Okay.
And we'll...
Yeah.
Things spiral from there.
And this isn't just some celestial soap opera.
Oh.
1st Enoch portrays this intermingling as a catalyst for all sorts of chaos. These watchers aren't just spreading their genes.
Right.
They're teaching humanity forbidden knowledge.
Yeah.
Essentially corrupting the very fabric of society.
And they're not handing out tips on agriculture or pottery.
No.
We're teaching humans about warfare.
Right.
Seduction. The creation of weapons.
Okay.
And even how to adorn themselves with cosmetics and jewelry.
So according to 1st Enoch... We can blame those fallen angels for both violence and vanity.
Right.
That's some serious cosmic baggage.
It is.
But seriously, it tackles that age-old question. Where does evil come from in a really compelling way?
Right. It goes beyond just stating that evil exists.
Yeah.
It tries to pinpoint its origin and how it spreads.
Right.
Linking it to the misuse of knowledge and the seduction of power themes that still resonate today.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And then there's Azazel, the ringleader of these rebellious angels. I remember him from the Day of Ownment rituals, that whole scapegoat thing.
Right.
But 1st Enoch portrays him as this full-blown demonic figure.
It's fascinating how they took a relatively obscure Old Testament figure and fleshed him out into this complex, almost Shakespearean villain.
All right.
It shows how these extra-canonical texts were interacting with existing scriptures. filling in the gaps and offering new interpretations.
So God obviously wasn't thrilled about this whole angel-human mashup, right?
No, you can say that.
Yeah.
He sends his Archangel A-team.
Okay.
Raphael, Michael Gabriel,
right,
to deal with the mess
and
punish the Watchers for corrupting humanity.
Yeah.
Azazel gets the worst of it.
Okay.
Cast into darkness, bound and isolated for his role as the rebellion's leader.
Sounds like a fitting end for a cosmic bad boy.
Right.
But first, Enoch doesn't stop there.
No.
We also encounter this Son of Man figure who shows up in the similitudes of Enoch.
And this is where things get really interesting, especially for those of us familiar with the New Testament. This Son of Man is connected to judgment, righteousness, and the ultimate triumph of good.
Yeah.
We hear echoes of this figure in Daniel's visions.
Right.
And of course, it becomes central to Jesus' own self-identification.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
Are we saying that first Enoch might have influenced how early Christians understood Jesus?
It's definitely a compelling connection.
That's huge.
The Son of Man in First Enoch is described as a pre-existent being closely connected to God, destined to judge the wicked and usher in a new era of peace.
Okay.
This rich tapestry of titles, Messiah, elect one, chosen one, points to the immense significance of this figure, mirroring how Christians would later come to understand Jesus.
This is blowing my mind.
Yeah.
It's like first Enoch is laying the groundwork for Jesus' own claims about his identity and mission.
Yeah.
And this Son of Man isn't just sitting around waiting for the end of the world.
No.
He has an active role
bringing
justice and light to the nation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's depicted as an agent of God's will,
very
much in line with the servant of the Lord we find in Isaiah.
Right.
He's a powerful figure
who
embodies the hope for a better world.
Yeah.
Which aligns perfectly with how Jesus is portrayed in the Gospels.
This is incredible. We've got fallen angels, forbidden knowledge, apocalyptic visions, and now we're seeing these clear connections to early Christian thought.
It is fascinating.
It's like First Enoch is a bridge between the Old and New Testaments, offering us a glimpse into the evolution of religious ideas.
It's giving us that wider context that we really need.
But hold on, didn't you say there's a second Enoch?
Oh, yeah.
And that's even more mind-bending.
It's a wild ride.
I can't wait to hear what that's all about.
It's a trip through multiple levels of heaven.
Okay.
Encounters with angels.
Yeah.
And some seriously mystical descriptions of the divine realm.
Right.
But I think we should save that journey for part two of our deep dive.
Okay.
Let's give our listeners a moment to process all this incredible information about First Enoch.
You're right. This is a lot to take in.
Yeah.
So for those of you joining us on this deep dive, stay tuned.
Yeah.
We're about to ascend to a whole new level, literally, as we explore the mysteries of Second Enoch.
You can't wait.
All right. Welcome back to our deep dive into the Book of Enoch. I'm still reeling from all the revelations in First Enoch.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Fallen angels, forbidden knowledge, and hints of Jesus' identity as the Son of Man. But we're not done yet, are we?
Not even close.
You mentioned that Second Enoch takes us on an even more mind-blowing journey.
Oh, absolutely.
So if First Enoch was about uncovering the roots of evil and hinting at the coming Messiah, Second Enoch is all about exploring the structure of the divine realm itself.
It's a cosmic travelogue.
Wow.
A guided tour through the seven levels of heaven.
Seven levels of heaven.
That's right.
That's a lot of real estate. I have to admit, I'm picturing some elaborate celestial skyscraper with angels operating the elevator.
Well, keep in mind that this is a symbolic representation of the divine realm.
Right.
An attempt to put into words what is ultimately beyond human comprehension.
Of course. So walk us through this cosmic skyscraper.
Okay.
What's on each floor?
All right. Let's start our ascent. The first level of heaven, as described in Second Enoch, is essentially the sky as we see it.
Okay.
The realm of stars, weather phenomena, rain, snow, and dew.
So it's not exactly pearly gates and streets paved with gold just yet.
No, not quite.
More like the lobby of heaven.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's fascinating how they connected the visible heavens, what they could observe in the sky, with the unseen realm of God.
Right.
It shows how intertwined those two concepts were in their worldview.
Makes sense. So what happens as we ascend to level two?
All right.
Do things get a bit more heavenly?
Well, heavenly might not be the right word here.
Okay.
On the second level, we encounter angels.
Mm-hmm.
But these are angels awaiting judgment.
Why more fallen angels?
It seems so.
Are we talking about the same watchers who messed things up in 1st Enoch?
2nd Enoch really emphasizes this idea of a cosmic rebellion,
mm-hmm.
a battle between good and evil that extends even into the heavenly realms.
Right.
These fallen angels are depicted as being held captive.
Okay.
Awaiting their final judgment.
So level 2 is like a celestial prison.
In a way, yes.
Not exactly a place I'd want to spend eternity.
Well, it does reflect the importance of justice and accountability.
Right.
Even in the divine order.
Yeah.
Every action has consequences.
Yeah.
Even for angels.
All right. So we've got sky on level 1,
mm-hmm.
angel prison on level 2.
Yeah.
Things are getting pretty intense.
It's a wild ride.
What awaits us on level 3?
Now, level 3 is where things take a turn for the better.
Okay.
This is paradise.
Paradise.
The realm of incredible beauty and tranquility, described as being between the incorruptible and the corruptible.
Okay, now we're talking.
It's where the righteous await their reward.
That sounds a lot more appealing than celestial prison.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Is this the same paradise that Jesus refers to when he's talking to the thief on the cross?
It's certainly possible.
Yeah.
And that's what makes these connections so fascinating.
Right.
2nd Enoch offers a glimpse into the broader world of Jewish beliefs about the afterlife, beliefs that would have influenced early Christians.
So it's like 2nd Enoch is providing a visual map, even if it's a symbolic one,
mm-hmm.
for these ideas about paradise.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're trying to grapple with the mysteries of what lies beyond this earthly life.
Right.
And these vivid descriptions would have resonated deeply with people who longed for a place of peace and rest.
Okay. So we've gone from sky to prison to paradise.
Right.
What awaits us as we continue our ascent?
Level 4 takes us into the realm of the cosmos.
Okay.
Here we find the celestial bodies that govern time, the sun,
mm-hmm.
moon,
yeah.
and stars.
So this level connects back to the creation account in Genesis.
Precisely.
Where God sets those heavenly bodies in place
mm-hmm.
to mark time.
2nd Enoch is building upon those foundational biblical narratives.
Right.
Adding layers of detail and interpretation.
It's like they're taking the raw materials of scripture
yeah.
and crafting these incredibly intricate and imaginative tapestries.
That's amazing.
I love that.
And as we move up to level 5,
okay.
we encounter another group of angels.
Mm.
But these are a special class.
They are the watchers who led other angels astray.
Right.
The same ones we encountered in 1st Enoch,
mm-hmm.
who were held responsible for corrupting humanity.
Oh, right. Those who taught humans about all the forbidden knowledge.
Exactly.
So they get their own special level of heaven.
Well, it does seem like they're being held separate from the other fallen angels.
Okay.
Perhaps highlighting their greater culpability.
Okay. 2 levels left.
All right.
What awaits us at level 6 and 7?
As we ascend to level 6,
okay.
we enter a realm of even greater holiness,
mm-hmm.
a place closer to the presence of God.
Wow.
This is where we find angels and archangels guarding the divine throne room.
It sounds like we're getting closer to the heart of the divine mystery.
It's getting intense.
What's it like on the 7th level?
The 7th level is the pinnacle of the celestial hierarchy.
Okay.
Here we find the cherubim,
mm-hmm.
seraphim wheels, and thrones.
Wow.
Imagery drawn straight from the prophetic visions in Isaiah and Ezekiel. Imagine those awe-inspiring descriptions of heavenly beings surrounding God's throne.
Right.
Praising and serving him.
It's like all those biblical threads are woven together to create this incredibly rich and complex tapestry of heaven.
And remember, yeah. some versions of 2nd Enoch place God's throne above this 7th level,
mm-hmm.
or even on a 10th level,
okay.
signifying the ultimate transcendence of the divine.
So we've journeyed through 7 levels of heaven.
It's an incredible journey.
From the familiar sky to a celestial prison,
yeah.
a paradise,
yeah.
a cosmic clockwork,
mm-hmm.
and multiple levels of angels,
right.
culminating in the throne room of God himself.
It's mind-blowing.
It's an incredible journey. But I have to ask,
yeah.
how did early Christians make sense of all these elaborate descriptions?
That's a great question.
Were they meant to be taken literally?
It's important to remember that these texts weren't meant to be taken as literal blueprints of the afterlife.
Okay.
They were symbolic representations, mm-hmm. attempts to grasp the ungraspable.
So it's more about the ideas they convey than the literal detail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those ideas had a profound impact on early Christian thought.
Right.
Think about the concept of angels awaiting judgment in 2nd Enoch.
Okay.
it resonates with passages in the New Testament, like 1 Peter 3.1820,
right,
where Peter describes Jesus preaching to the spirits in prison who disobeyed during Noah's time.
Right. Peter seems to be drawing on those same traditions about fallen angels being held captive in the heavenly realms.
It's remarkable how these ideas traveled.
Yeah.
And were reinterpreted in different contexts.
Uh-huh.
And it highlights how crucial it is to understand this wider world of Jewish thought and literature.
Right.
If we want to fully grasp the New Testament.
It's like 2nd Enoch is giving us a behind-the-scenes look at the development of early Christian ideas.
Absolutely.
About the afterlife and the cosmic drama of good versus evil.
It's fascinating.
But there's one more piece of the puzzle we need to explore. Paul's experience of being caught up to the third heaven.
Oh, yeah.
How does that fit into all of this?
That's a fascinating connection.
Yeah.
And one we'll definitely explore in part 3 of our deep dive.
Okay.
We'll see how Paul's mystical experience might relate to those levels of heaven described in 2nd Enoch.
Right.
And how it influenced early Christian understanding of the divine realm.
Okay, I'm on the edge of my seat.
Me too.
Let's move on to part 3 and unravel that mystery.
Let's go.
Okay. We've journeyed through the Watcher's Rebellion in 1st Enoch.
Right.
And scaled the heights of heaven in 2nd Enoch.
What a trip.
But there's one piece of the puzzle that's been nagging at me.
Okay.
Paul's experience of being caught up to the third heaven in 2 Corinthians 12.
Oh, yeah.
It's so cryptic.
It's a really mysterious passage.
So mysterious. What do you make of it?
Well, it's definitely one of the most intriguing passages in the New Testament.
Right.
Especially when we consider what we've learned from 2 Enoch. Remember how the third level of heaven was described as paradise?
Right.
That place of extraordinary beauty and tranquility.
Right.
Where the righteous await their reward.
And Paul uses the terms third heaven and paradise almost interchangeably.
He does.
Could it be that he's drawing on this existing framework of a multi-level heaven to describe his own mystical experience?
It's a very strong possibility.
That's amazing.
It suggests that this concept of a multi-level heaven wasn't some fringe idea, but a well-established tradition within early Jewish thought.
Mm-hmm.
That also influenced early Christian writers.
So when Paul says he was caught up,
he's
not just talking about some vague spiritual feeling.
Right.
He's describing a journey into a specific realm, a realm that he understood through the lens of these existing traditions about heaven.
Exactly. And it's fascinating that he specifically mentions the third heaven.
Yeah, why the third?
Why not the seventh, where God's throne is located, according to 2nd Enoch?
You know, it makes me wonder if there's some significance to the number 3 in this context.
Okay.
It often symbolizes completeness or perfection in ancient traditions.
Right.
Could Paul be emphasizing the fullness of the revelation he received?
Mm.
The sense of being completely immersed in the divine presence.
That's a very insightful observation.
Thanks.
It would certainly explain why he struggles to put his experience into words.
Right.
He calls it inexpressible, suggesting that it was beyond human language and comprehension.
It's like trying to describe the taste of chocolate to someone who's never had it before.
Yeah.
You can use all the words in the world,
right?
But they'll never fully grasp the experience until they taste it for themselves.
Exactly. And this reminds us that these texts, well, biblical and extra-canonical, often deal with mysteries that defy simple explanations.
Yeah.
They invite us to grapple with the big questions, to push the boundaries of our understanding, and to embrace the wonder and awe that lie at the heart of faith.
Beautifully put.
Thank you.
But there's one more New Testament connection that I'd like to explore.
Okay.
It's the idea of Jesus descending to the realm of the dead.
Right.
Which is mentioned in several places, including 1 Peter 3.1820.
Yes. The passage where Peter talks about Jesus preaching to the spirits in prison who disobeyed during Noah's time.
It's a powerful image.
It is.
And one that connects directly back to 2nd Enoch.
It did.
If we think about the second level of heaven in 2nd Enoch, the one where those fallen angels are held captive awaiting judgment, it's not hard to see how Peter might be drawing on that imagery.
It really paints a picture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It suggests that Jesus, after his death on the cross, descended into this celestial prison to proclaim his victory over the forces of evil.
Right.
It's a concept that would have resonated deeply with early Christians who believed that Christ's power extended even into the realm of the dead.
It's like we're seeing all these different threads, biblical, extra-canonical.
Yeah.
theological weaving together to create this incredible tapestry of early Christian thought.
And the Book of Enoch, even though it's outside the official canon, plays a vital role in helping us understand the broader context of early Christianity.
I agree.
It provides valuable insights into the ideas, beliefs, and traditions that shaped the faith of those early believers.
It's been an incredible journey.
Oh, yeah.
We've encountered fallen angels, scaled the heights of heaven, delved into ancient mysteries, and even caught glimpses of how early Christians understood Jesus and the afterlife.
It's really amazing to think about, isn't it?
It really is.
And I think one of the key takeaways is this: the more we understand the historical, cultural, and literary context of the Bible, the richer and more meaningful our engagement with it becomes.
I completely agree.
Texts like the Book of Enoch offer valuable pieces of that puzzle, helping us see the bigger picture and appreciate the complexity and depth of early Christian thought.
Absolutely. And for those of you listening, I encourage you to keep exploring.
That's right.
There's a whole world of ancient wisdom waiting to be discovered. And who knows what mind-blowing insights you might find. Until next time, fellow knowledge seekers.
See you then.